station on re-entry, then reminded herself. Put them away like Hound Squadron, like the Cavern Angels. None of this is new to you. How long was I out? Chas asked. Been perhaps a day since the battle. We've been out salvaging scrap. Now we're heading home. You're lying, she said. Nothing he said was implausible. It wasn't as if Shadow Wing hadn't beaten the New Republic before, but the reply ripped through her anyway. Where's my ship? Where's my B-Wing? If she could drain the skiff's fuel supply, she could head out, hit Shadow Wing with the advantage of surprise, bring down the cruiser carrier, get revenge for her squadron, and set everything right. Too big for the skiff to haul, Groiver said, and looked almost sincere in his sympathy. I am sorry. Chas parted her lips, but found nothing to say. The third crew member, who hadn't spoken prior, rotated its jelly stalk of a head and squealed something. Groiver nodded and declared, Good. Radio the planet and tell them to prepare housing for another guest. Chas was barely listening. The sound of the chanting lingered in her ears, and she went from thoughts of revenge to thoughts of music, and the realization that if her ship was lost, so was the collection she'd accumulated. Rare songs, banned songs, the work of dead singers and dead civilizations. Some of the recordings, she suspected, were unique in the galaxy. They were gone like Will, Anath, and Quell. We'll get you to Katadra, Groiver said. Clean you up, feed you, figure out where to go from there, eh? Am I a prisoner? Chas asked, her voice dull and distant. Hostage of the cult? You're whatever you want to be, and whatever the Force desires, Groiver said, which was a clear enough answer to Chas. For a zealot, the Force desired whatever the believer wanted. She'd flown to Katadra on over 20 bombing runs, but the solar skiff was slower than an assault fighter, and she watched as the band of temples and palaces and bridges and stairways around the mountains came into sight. Groiver brought her tea and spoke platitudes as they flew, and Chas considered grappling with him and trying to take control of the ship. She was outnumbered, though, and she saw no weapons, not a blaster, not a knife, not even a hydro spanner or a wrench heavy enough to brain a man. That meant she was dealing with low-level cultists. She didn't know much about the Children of the Empty Sun, but all cults were alike. They preached peace and armed their leaders well. Midway through their descent, the Jellystock crew member squeaked a warning. An instant later, the skiff lurched and made a sound like lightning striking a dead tree. Chas felt herself float for a fraction of a second before she dropped hard onto her knees and caught a glimpse of Emerald outside the viewport. Then smoke filled her vision and Groiver shouted, Abandon ship! The Groiver's skiff was going down. Chas wasn't about to grieve, and she might have laughed at the idea of dying so soon after her rescue if she hadn't started choking. One of the cultists, the furry one by the feel of the hand on Chas's neck, pushed her forward and through a hatch barely large enough for one body. Yet the woman wriggled into the compartment alongside her, and Chas breathed in ashes and the odor of unclean hair.
Go, stupid thing! Go!
The woman cried, pounding her palm against the walls of the narrow compartment. The skiff lurched again, and Chas wrenched her body, positioning herself so she could see through the hands-width viewport centimeters from her nose. The universe was spinning and the compartment was tumbling, and she understood that she was in an escape pod, ejected from its parent vessel and falling toward Katadra. She caught a glimpse above of a single tie racing away from a burning, plummeting ovoid with metallic solar sails painted in cacophonous hues. Her hand slid across the pod's instrumentation. Her companion yelped as Chas dug her elbow into its fur. Chas ignored the woman and found a primitive control yoke. The pod lacked a true engine, but it had maneuvering thrusters, and by shifting her weight and wrenching at the yoke, she found she could adjust her angle of descent. The light of the solar projectors painted a clear image of the land below, the ancient stone buildings built into the mountainside, and the dark vegetation on the far slopes. It looks different when you're not being shot at, she thought. She resolved to choose a landing site and deliver the escape pod like a bomb. She'd bombed Katadra before. She knew how to hit a target. She spotted a crater where a turbo laser emplacement had formerly stood between two granite towers. Hit you once already, she muttered, and felt her skin tingle as the pod's electromagnetic brakes kicked in. She tuned out the chanted prayers of her companion and braced for impact. Chas survived the fall. Her companion didn't. After the crash, the woman with fur and fangs lay beneath Chas with her head unnaturally twisted. The body was still warm and close enough that Chas would have felt a heartbeat if she'd survived. Chas very nearly felt pity. She very nearly whispered a prayer of the inheritors of the crystal to commend the dead woman to the Force. Instead, she climbed out of the pod as swiftly as she was able and studied the city around her. The TIE flitted across the Katadrin sky for nearly an hour, occasionally dipping low enough to spew emerald fire at a structure and obliterate it as thoroughly, if not as rapidly, as any proton bomb could. Chas kept watch as she trekked through the streets, allowing the current of the crowds to determine her direction. Packed shoulder to shoulder with fleeing locals from 100 species, she managed to blend despite her New Republic flight suit. No one noticed in all the chaos. She was confident that Ty was targeting communications stations and landing pads, cutting off Katadra from the rest of the Cerberon system and the rest of the galaxy. On foot, unarmed, and ignorant of the planet, there wasn't anything Chas could do to interfere. But she still had a working brain, and she figured that if Shadow Wing had only sent a single TIE, it meant the Empire's grip on Cerberon wasn't secure. It meant the enemy was afraid of a counterattack, or of anyone fleeing with a call for New Republic reinforcements. Nothing else, Chas thought. It was invigorating to smell fear. She needed a ship. Whatever she planned to do next, she'd need a ship for it. As she passed beneath a line of battlements, she heard shouting above. Stained and yellowing stormtrooper helmets rested in the gaps of the crenellations. Trophies or warnings or both from the days after the Empire had fled. Katadrins grabbed the helmets up by the armful. Not a forgiving people, but they're not stupid. Not the display you want if the Empire's coming back. Assuming she found a ship, could she drive Shadow Wing off single-handedly or get a message to General Syndulla? The old instincts returned to her, the anticipation of dying gloriously to defeat an enemy who devastated her squadron, screaming a song as she flew into the heart of a carrier. But the taste was sour. It was Alphabet that had lured Shadow Wing to Cerberon in the first place, at the behest of a genocidal traitor named Irika Quell, and the war was too close to its end for a glorious sacrifice to mean anything. She'd probably survive anyway, and then she'd be in the same predicament as always. Half a dozen screaming humans leapt across a gap in a broken bridge ahead of her, calling out something about hidden heretics. Chas wondered if there was anywhere she could get a drink, and waited for the current of the crowd to bring her to a cantina. By midnight, she'd decided, after her third bottle, not to drink after all. She wasn't an addict, she told herself. She'd gotten in the habit of filling her downtime with diversions, but she didn't need a diversion tonight. She found another customer at the cantina, willing to trade a drab olive shirt and engineer's trousers for her flight suit, and she began asking questions about Katadra's local power players. Of the half-dozen cults to come to sudden prominence in the months since Endor, the Children of the Empty Sun was the largest. Mostly, a long-beaked Ishi-Tib told her. Because they distribute food through the settlements, assign refugees direct old palaces for housing, I wouldn't trust them. But if someone's going to govern, better the children than the devourers of all light or one of the other freak shows. Chas nodded and tried to concentrate on the words instead of her memory of the last Ishi-Tib she'd known. She really had liked Satanique. Put him away like Hound Squadron. When she left the cantina, she was halfway to forming a plan. Sometime after her first bottle, she'd remembered what Groiver had said aboard the skiff. Tell them to prepare housing for another guest. It wasn't proof that the children had taken other New Republic prisoners, but it was a possibility, and a second set of hands would be one more set to help strangle the imps. So, Chas strolled through the crowds, thinner in the early morning darkness, camped around portable heaters and vaporators in the streets, until she reached the white and azure-tiled palace the Ishi-Tib had told her about. A man in sallow robes stood under a 4-meter archway inlaid with flying serpent mosaics. Chas noted the rifle-shaped bulge under the robes without surprise.
No more food tonight, the man said. Come back in the morning.
Don't need food, Chas said. My name's Maya Halleck. I'm spiritually lost, really at loose ends right now. Figured I'd find guidance here, so I want to join up.
She might have been more convincing if she'd bothered to work on her story, but she'd never met a cult keen on turning recruits away. She doubted the Children of the Empty Sun would be any different from the mix of con artists and fanatics and pathetic seekers she'd met so many times before. She swallowed her distaste and smiled brightly, showing her teeth. 2. Irika Quell couldn't remember dreaming, but she rose in the red desert more unsettled than when she'd fallen asleep. She recalled waking periodically to the sensation of tremors, quakes she could only feel with her cheek pressed against the tarp. Occasionally, she'd also half-consciously repositioned herself to alleviate pain in her spine. Otherwise, her rest had gone undisturbed.
"This shouldn't be here,"
she said, to herself as much as to Aiden, as she dripped water from the portable evaporator into their canteen. They breakfasted together on a single ration bar Quell had broken in half.
"What shouldn't?"
Aiden asked. He sat on the tarp with his back against the ship. They'd taken down their makeshift tent. The wind seemed quiescent in the morning dark, as if intimidated by the rising eye of the black hole.
"The water. The atmosphere shouldn't have so much moisture. There shouldn't be an atmosphere this dense at all on a planetoid so small."
Aiden stared across at her. She noticed that he'd barely eaten from his portion.
"Does that mean anything?"
he asked,
"aside from proving that the universe is full of wonder?"
There was no humor in his voice. Quell didn't laugh.
"No,"
she said, and took a swig from the canteen. Quell ate her tasteless, stale meal with the mechanical discipline of a pilot taught never to allow her feelings to interfere with nourishment. Aiden took imperceptibly small bites, but in the end, his half bar was gone too. Quell briefly wondered if he'd tucked away the remainder, but decided it was his meal. He could eat it when he wanted. After breakfast, they performed another cursory search of the wreckage, finding nothing new, before Quell attempted to reconstruct the final flight and disintegration of the freighter, drawing trajectories in the dust to estimate where the other half of the ship had fallen. She and Aiden agreed without discussion, without actual agreement, to go look for whatever might have survived. Quell had little hope that the droid was still intact, but perhaps there would be something more. The ship's long-range comm unit, or a portable scanner they could use to locate the energy readings that had led them to the planetoid in the first place. They didn't have packs or satchels. That was fine, Quell thought, because there wasn't enough of anything to pack. The journey through the desert was slow going. Although the hard-packed sand offered a measure of traction and the dunes were low and gentle, their injuries made each step effortful. Aiden fared worse than Quell, and while they started side by side, she left him a meter behind, then 10, then 20, as the morning wore on. When he diminished to a dark silhouette on the horizon, she was tempted to increase her pace. She envisioned Aiden's plodding steps taking him deeper into the dunes until he was buried neck deep, until the wind rose and the sand flayed him alive. The gruesomeness of the image surprised Quell. Morbid fantasies had never been her vice. She waited for Aiden a while, then she turned and crossed the distance to him. "You need to rest?" she asked. But he shook his head, and they continued together across the endless plain of red. They spotted the corpse from afar, but until they were closer, they didn't recognize it for what it was, the body of an Imperial stormtrooper swaddled in dust. Patches of white plastoid armor uncovered by sand stood out like bone. "Dead?" Erica Quell said. The first word either she or Aiden had spoken for nearly an hour. She nudged the corpse with a boot and sent an avalanche of sand tumbling from its back. A plume of finer dust rose like smoke from the scorched hole between the trooper's shoulders.
"For how long?"
Aiden asked. Quell shrugged.
"You tell me."
She waited for Aiden to answer, but he stared in confusion. And she elaborated.
"The place we found you, the Imperial hideout on Narthex. The unit there had charts of the debris field, like they'd been here before." "This is one of them?"
Aiden asked. Before Quell could reply, he shook his head.
"No, it's possible, but I don't remember much. If they were out here, it was without me, and most likely before I was kidnapped."
Quell nodded and stepped around the body. She scanned the sand for a rifle or anything else useful the dead man might have carried. There was nothing.
"What was here for them?"
Aiden asked. Irritation flared inside her.
"Why would I know more than you?"
"You might have seen something during the approach,"
Aiden said.
"During landing."
The irritation remained, though Quell could admit that Aiden's reasoning was sound.
"Some sort of energy reading coming from the planet. I didn't have a chance to examine it. I doubt the ship's sensors could have given us much more anyway."
"An energy reading,"
Aiden repeated. He knelt, but he was more than a meter from the body, too far to examine it with any real scrutiny.
"Assume they were here for the source, then. To retrieve it? To plant it?"
"How about this?"
Quell countered.
"Who died and how?"
Were there other bodies to be found? Would they all be shot in the back? Maybe the stormtrooper refused to go along with a mission he couldn't abide. She started to laugh before the ground began to quiver. The tremors weren't enough to unbalance her, but they were impossible not to notice. Then, after several seconds, the quivering ended with a jolt that sent the sandy caps of dunes rippling down slopes. Quell looked to Aiden. He had his hand pressed to the ground for support, but now he rose again. They resumed their walk. Quell found her mind drifting as if she were on the verge of sleep, as if she were half dreaming. With logical throughways replaced by a labyrinth of symbols and preoccupations. She trudged through the desert and thought about Shadow Wing and what had gone wrong with the trap she had set to lure the unit to asteroid CER-952B. She thought about Major Soren Keyes and fought to remember whether his promise to leave the 204th had been a figment,
Whether her departure was a figment, and she had come to Cerberon with her Imperial comrades and captured the new Republic intelligence officer, Cairn Aiden. She thought about Chasna Chattuck and Will Lark and Nath Tensant, and imagined them fighting Shadow Wing, being picked off one by one. Every time they'd fought Shadow Wing without her, they'd lost. Why would now be any different? The Eye of Cerberon was high in the sky when it occurred to her to worry about her own mental state. Maybe it was her injuries, concussion or blood loss or both, that disoriented her. Maybe it was the planetoid's atmosphere. She didn't know how safe it was to breathe. She tried to focus on surviving after that. Whatever was going on, she had enough problems without worrying about matters far outside her control. They encountered fragments of the freighter buried in the sand, broken sections of bulkheads or scorched hull plating, once a landing strut standing erect atop a dune like a flagpole, but nothing intact, nothing salvageable. There was no sign of the interrogation droid. Quell and Aiden still did not speak, but Quell stayed nearer to Aiden than she had for most of the morning and recognized that he was slowing. She heard him begin gasping with every step and suppressed her annoyance. "He's not doing it to irk you," she told herself, though she wasn't totally convinced. They found a half-cylinder wall from the freighter's access corridor and rested in its arc, protected from the wind. They shared another ration bar and what water the vaporator produced. Afterward, Quell was ready to continue the hike. Aiden's head lolled against the metal plating, his eyes half closed. If he hadn't been breathing, Quell would have thought him dead. "Aiden," she said. The man did not respond.
"Cairn,"
she said. He groaned and lifted his eyelids, squinting at Quell.
"What is it?"
"You're hurt. Maybe you're dying. We need to assess your wounds and discuss what to do if you can't keep walking. Whether I should leave you behind."
"You're slowing down."
Aiden grunted and closed his eyes again. He would slip away if she didn't act. "Is that what you want?"
"Why are you so worried for Kairos?"
she asked. It wasn't the question she'd planned, but it had seemed safe in the moment, unlikely to draw Aiden's ire.
"Why does it matter?"
he said. Quell shrugged. The motion hurt dully.
"Tell me or don't tell me."
She squatted in the sand and shifted on her heels, preparing to rise. Before she could stand, Aiden said,
"Wait,"
and she lowered herself again. She waited a long time for him to speak. This is the story he told.
"We met in the camp,"
Aiden said, and though Quell didn't ask what the camp was, she thought first of Traitor's Remorse, and then, reluctantly, of the holding facilities and labor outposts she'd often seen listed on Imperial military star charts. She thought of the rebel recruiting videos she'd watched at the age of 16, grainy, hollow footage of electrified fences and emaciated alien bodies.
"I'd been held for maybe 3 months, just long enough for me to realize that I was going to be there a lot longer, that my employers had given up on me or been shut down altogether, that my captors had gone from imprisoning me because I was suspicious to being suspicious because I was imprisoned. I decided my best hope was to wait for a new warden to arrive and audit the entire facility. Maybe some freshly appointed Imperial overseer wouldn't lose face for tossing me back to the streets of Koru Neimoidia. It wasn't a stupid hope, thinking I could last the 5-10 years it might take before a change in management, though. That was stupid."
Aiden had been a financial journalist in his former life, he told Quell. It was the first time he'd told her anything about his existence before the Rebel Alliance. He'd been detained after publishing a story about droid production forecasts on Kol Hurro, though he still didn't know why.
They asked about the article. They asked about a lot of things I'd written.
But it was after that third month that he'd been transferred from the outer sections of the camp to the inner compound. He'd gone from a bunk room shared with five other prisoners to a private, windowless cell, barely wide enough to sit with legs outstretched. He'd lacked any way to tell time. His meals came inconsistently, and the compound lights were kept at the same dim levels at all hours. With his antenna stalks fully extended, he could hear voices from the cells above and below his own, but fear prevented him from attempting to make contact.
"I thought they'd amputate them if they caught me," Aiden said, gingerly touching his scalp where the stalks were retracted. "If they knew I was listening." So I listened less and less, even though it was my only way of connecting.
He only left his cell for two reasons. Sometimes, it might have been once a week, but it felt random. A stormtrooper would escort him to the Duracrete pit in the complex center for exercise. The pit was 5 meters deep, and it was almost always cold, but it was broad enough to let a person pace and even run for as long as the troopers permitted.
"You could see the sky, too," Aiden said. "Sometimes I just sat and watched the sky."
The other reason he left his cell was for interrogation.
Making us walk to the droid instead of the droid coming to us, that was part of the process. That was to intimidate us.
He hadn't seen a living interrogator since being moved into the compound, more evidence that he no longer mattered.
"But sometimes, when we were on our way or coming back to the droid, that's when we saw someone else in passing, coming back or going to their own session. We'd cross paths. We'd walk within centimeters of another person, someone who wasn't locked in a stormtrooper's helmet. There were three of us whose schedules matched up. I don't know how many in the camp, but there were three of us who saw one another walking to interrogation. That's how I met Kairos."
The moments of connection gave Aiden no hope, but they gave him something to look forward to. Something to help chart the passage of time. Every time he saw Kairos, he saw how she'd changed, what she'd suffered, and he knew that she saw the same in him. Quell strained to understand what that meant, what Aiden had seen in the strange, silent woman. Whether she'd been unmasked, how she had changed. But Aiden said nothing more, and Quell felt asking would have been obscene. Yet Aiden spoke freely of the last member of their trio.
"Ver Iflin. You could see the defiance every time."
The way he spoke made it seem to Quell like he was lying.
"He was the one who figured out how to communicate. He'd known another man of my species, understood what we could sense, and he spoke to me from his cell. I don't know how many months after they put me in the compound, but I started to listen again. Ver Iflin made a plan. He spoke to me even though I could never speak to him. He started the work, and he didn't get to see the end. But we did. I did. And she did."
Aiden did not speak again for a long while. Quell finally asked,
"How did you escape?"
Aiden groaned softly, as if he were too weak to shrug and the sound was all he could offer.
"How do you think?" he said next. "We made a new friend. Ver Iflin was gone, but he worked miracles with machines. We became three again." "The interrogation droid?" "Reprogrammed, yes. Cairn, Kairos, and Ito."
Quell said nothing. There was no comfort she could offer. There was no question she believed he would answer.
"You asked about Kairos," Aiden eventually said, and sat up rapidly for a man in his condition.
He opened his eyes and looked to Quell.
"What matters is that she saw me, and I saw her. We three were bound together. Now I may be the last of us alive." "You don't know that," she said.
I know it's possible, he said. So do you.
She stood and offered him a hand. He looked at her knuckles, covered in dried blood, with disdain, but pulled himself up by her forearm anyway. The Eye of Cerberon was setting behind them when the ground began to slope downward and red cliffs rose in the distance. They encountered fragments of the freighter less often, but still spotted the occasional reflection off a hull plate or the serpent's spine of a cable rising from sand. Quell was considering how to proceed if they reached the edge of the wreckage, whether to return to the ship or continue on into the unknown, when the quaking returned. This time the tremors were enough to kick her forward. She doubled over and swept her fingers through the sand before regaining balance. Aiden remained standing, though she heard his breathing become rapid and shallow. Instead of calming, the tremors intensified. Quell grasped Aiden by the forearm, as much for her sake as his, and they stumbled headlong. They ran to keep from falling on the downward slope, and a wind rose as the quake propelled them. A few seconds later, a crack entirely unlike thunder resonated through the valley, and darkness stained the sand. Quell feared a chasm was forming until the darkness leapt up in thick, jagged ridges. Black stones tore from the ground like the disease-racked bones of the planetoid. The megalithic boulders were tall as Aiden, and they plagued the valley at random. Few were clustered close together. Quell pulled Aiden along as though the rocks were liable to impale them both. Fear incited her, and after the quaking began to subside, it was only Aiden's weakness that dragged her to a halt. They both fell to the ground, and Quell felt her knees scraped raw by the sand. The last tremors died away. Quell stared at the ground, trying to steady her breathing.
Are you all right?
Aiden asked, soft and anxious.
I'm fine, she said.
When she looked up, she saw he hadn't been talking to her. A dozen paces away floated a metal sphere, festooned with sensors and surgical manipulators. Gouges marred its black paint, and several of its indicators were dimly lit, as if the interior bulbs were broken, but the red glow of its photoreceptor was undiminished. Its underside was caked in sand, and it hummed low enough that Quell felt her teeth buzz.
I am functional,
ITO said. Its servos whirred, and Quell realized its axis was slightly atilt.
I have been unable to access my full diagnostic suite, but my programs and memory are within acceptable parameters for emergency operations.
Aiden smiled tightly. Bowed his head, swaying slightly as he stood. Quell brushed herself off, rose, and asked,
Where have you been? Did you see anything?
I was pulled into the engine compartment when the hull was breached. I fell to ground near the cliffs north of here and only re-established full movement a short time ago.
The droid paused.
While I charged my repulsors, I had time to analyze the tremors along with the readings we took during our approach.
Aiden massaged his hip, but didn't look away from the droid.
Good news, I assume?
For someone, no doubt.
The droid agreed.
Although the higher math eludes me, I believe this planetoid's orbit was recently disrupted. It is moving rapidly toward the black hole at the center of the system.
The wind rose up again. Quell tasted dust between her teeth. She was tempted to spit it out, but choked down the grit instead. She didn't have water to waste.
How long do we have? She asked.
I'm not certain,
the droid said.
But the planetoid is not massive. It will disintegrate long before we reach the black hole. I estimate no more than a few days.
Neither Aiden nor Quell spoke for a while. They did not look at one another.
We should get moving,
Quell said, though she didn't know where they should go. 3.
The Y-Wing descended over the district locals called the Web, and Nath Tenzint cursed his droid with every centimeter. The vessel swung to and fro on the breeze, its thrusters offline, carried only by repulsors in the hope of avoiding detection. Any miscalculation could prove fatal, Nath knew, as they passed through the gaps between Duracrete tubes spanning the district like spider's silk.
You get us killed,
Nath said.
You and I are gonna have a talk.
The droid squawked an irritated reply. Well, that boy of yours will be annoyed if you come back without me.
The tubes, closer to sewers than skyways in breadth and odor, connected the district's aging factories. Nowadays, most of the factories were decommissioned. The district's population resided almost entirely inside the tubing. Some were brightly painted with murals or flags, while more were stained with an orange moss that ate away at the rough surface like acid. Two proton bombs and this whole place will fall apart, Nath thought, though Shadow Wing patrols hadn't been seen in the area for a while. Even elsewhere, the bombing runs seemed fewer than earlier. Nath suspected they were conserving ammunition. A sensor sweep revealed his destination, a broad tube decorated with crude images of Tuca cats. The Y-Wing crept forward, and a metal hatch swung open, giving the ship no more than half a meter's clearance on any side. Still, Nath managed to creep forward. T5 did most of the work, but he kept an eye on his instruments, and he waited for his vision to adjust to the dim lighting within. Gathered in the tube were several dozen ragged civilians packed among tents and semi-portable generators and heating units and strings of glow bulbs. They parted to make room for the Y-Wing as it settled. The residents were humans, mostly, the descendants of noble and merchant families fallen from grace long ago, though many had been altered or augmented. Nath spotted cybernetic interface plugs and surgical appetite limiters, and experienced a cocktail of nostalgia and disdain for the gangs of his youth. The ship lurched onto its landing gear. Nath gripped his sidearm as the crowd pressed in. He'd been told to find his contact here, that the residents had loathed Governor Hastemore and saw the New Republic as a chance to permanently improve their circumstances. But he'd expected subterfuge, not a public confrontation with a crowd ready to riot. They roared as he popped his canopy. He stood from his seat, squinted into the darkness, and grinned toothily at the locals in their starving, pathetic glory. Their cries were almost buoyant, and Nath thought back to the initial campaign for the planet. All the times he'd returned from a mission to the applause of infantry or refugees. He'd expected opinions to sour with the arrival of Shadow Wing, whereas instead, the civilians' despair was cut with the manic hope he associated with the Rebel Alliance. This time, their hopes were pinned on him. Be careful, you're getting used to the attention. He dropped out of the Y-Wing and was caught by two burly men with painted faces. A greasy-haired brute held a child above the crowd, and out of irrational instinct, Nath slapped a ration bar into the kid's hand, knowing it would either encourage the crowd or send them tearing at his flesh for more. They called out questions.
What's going on in Thanner House? When is the Empire landing ground troops? Is it true the governor is alive?
He shouted in a booming voice that echoed in the vast tube.
Hey, we're gonna talk about all that. Anything I can answer before I have to head back, I'll answer. But first, you need to help out my pals. I'm not in charge of the troops. I was sent here on a special mission to find you, because only you can help us. We need supplies, equipment. Most important, we need transport. I can't say where or how, but we're taking the fight to the enemy. We won Troyth before, and we can win it all over again.
The crowd thundered back,
voices merging, but generally upbeat so far as Nath could tell. He caught snatches of inquiries, responded where he could, and caught the eye of a man no taller than Nath's breast, wobbling forward on spindly mechanical legs. The others in the crowd backed away, though they grew no quieter, as the compact man said, "What kind of transport?"
"Air and ground," Nath answered. "Sturdy as you can. You don't want to know details, but assume rough flying and rough ground."
The man's legs extended until he was face to face with Nath.
"Showroom's closed, but I bet we can figure something out. You know what this place is, don't you?" "The web?" "Before it was the web," the man snapped. "These factories, transport was what we did until the Empire shut us down. Kept promising they'd switch us to manufacturing ties, but they never did. The B-14, most popular airspeeder on Troith, built right here, made of materials mined on Troith by workers born on Troith. You want flitters, stair crawlers, rumblers? We'll make it happen."
"You got a price?" Nath asked. He enjoyed a good sales pitch, smiled to show he understood, but he was still skeptical.
"You get the Empire off-world, the New Republic gets the factories running again."
"It's a deal." True, he didn't have the authority to make the deal. By the time the residents of the web realized that, however, he intended to be far away from Troith and the Cerberon system. When Nath was done with the web, he rendezvoused with the troops outside the Highgarden district. Even keeping his speed down and his starfighter low enough to avoid scanners, he'd flown across a third of the continent and back in the time the infantry needed to creep 20 kilometers.
"Think we'll get what we need?" he told Will, slapping one of the boy's skinny shoulders. "I told them not to bother with anything slower than a combat-rated cloud car." "Jeems," that's the old factory foreman, "says he expects he can dig up a dozen aircraft that meet our specs, plus the ground transport. Assume he's exaggerating, and it's still better than we expected."
"Good," Will said. They strolled through a narrow alley between the empty lot where they'd parked their ships and the decaying playground the 61st Mobile Infantry used as a camp.
"I spent most of the day selecting pilots. No one with starfighter experience, but there's a few good candidates. Vitaly used to fly atmospheric patrols for local security. Prince Pai says he... she, maybe? Their species has wings when they're young, so that suggests a knack for maneuvering. I should have a final roster by tonight."
"Admit it, you love being in command." Nath grinned. With another man, he might have joked about leaving Quell aboard the Lodestar on purpose. He knew better than to try it with Will.
"You feeling good about them?"
The lines in Will's stubbly cheeks seemed like chasms as he smiled, and Nath imagined the strands of his hair turning gray.
"Even if they can fly, I'm gonna have to teach them combat tactics, squadron maneuvers, and everything we know about Shadow Wing in, what, a few days? This might be our best shot, but I wouldn't say I'm feeling good."
Nath thought about whether to question Will further or change the topic to something innocuous. He was saved from the decision by T5. The droid rolled along the cracked pavement, chiming and squawking, and Will raced to the machine's side, suddenly boyish again. Will stayed close to the Astromech as he returned to his pilot interviews. Nath observed from afar, but didn't interfere as soldiers sat with Will and T5 beneath the playground equipment. Bright-eyed youths and scarred veterans, both humans and species Nath couldn't recognize. Tired and endlessly patient, Will sketched formations in the dirt and sent candidates away and welcomed others back. T5 didn't leave Will's side, even after they settled onto the grass to sleep. Nath didn't chide the droid, though it should have been performing low-level systems checks on the Y-Wing. He suspected they were both thinking about Piter, the scared kid Nath had taught everything to, the kid he had protected as they'd defected from the Empire to join the Rebel Alliance. Piter had been the first to die when Shadow Wing had ambushed their squadron at the Trenchinovu shipyards. T5 and Nath were the only living witnesses to that battle. Will seemed apt to last longer than Piter. Hell, Nath thought, Will's a better pilot than Piter ever was. But how long did any of them have on Troyth? Nath lay on his back, staring through the jungle gym at the two bright stars. He'd taken too many risks to get revenge for Piter and Ferris and Rika and the rest. He'd been stupid to try and lucky to survive. He couldn't afford to seek revenge a second time. The grenade bounced through the dying grass so softly that Nath woke, believing it was a soldier's tread. The deafening explosion and accompanying flash disabused him of that, and as his sight and hearing shut down, he felt soil and shards of pavement spray his face. He rolled onto his knees, fumbled for his blaster, and tried to figure out where to point. Troops shouted around him, but their words were lost in the ocean waves and door chimes noise in his throbbing ears. Nath cursed and fought the urge to fire a blind shot. "I can't see," he yelled, and someone's arms wrapped around his body. He felt himself dragged across the grounds as the ozone stench of blasters filled the air. By the time his hearing and vision began to return, his savior was gone. He stood inside the alley mouth, looking onto the playground as crimson energy streaked down from the windows of a 5-story stone schoolhouse. The troops on the playground were scattering to escape the kill zone. On the opposite end of the playground from Nath, pinned behind an oversized child's model of a pod racer, were dark blurs that might have been Will and T5, along with several soldiers attempting to return fire. There was no way Nath could reach Will without getting a dozen charred holes in his chest. If he wanted to save his comrade, he'd have to find another way. He took one last moment to assess the battlefield, then stumbled down the alley, trying to shake off his vertigo. He passed a soldier crouched by a form caked in blood and dirt, a civilian, to judge by the clothes, likely a sympathizer who'd helped the company make camp and offered a plate of food. Nath didn't speak to either, twisting his face into something between a grimace and a smile when he spotted the Y-Wing, ugly as ever, intact on its slab of pavement. He hauled himself into the cockpit and fumbled through startup procedures, a process slow and clumsy without T5's assistance. But he didn't need the astromech for what he had planned. The ringing in his ears was replaced by the growl of the ship's engine. Systems checks came next, then manual power distribution, to thrusters, to stabilizers, to shields, to weapons, all in the right order so that nothing overtaxed the reactor. The vessel's atmospheric compensators cycled, attempting to balance the Y-Wing for planetary flight. Nath overrode them and retracted his landing gear. Then he was ascending, and a cloud of hot dust expanded outward from his position. He remembered the soldier and civilian in the alley and imagined them caught in his backwash. "Sorry, boys," he thought. But they'd survive, or if not, it wouldn't be Nath who pushed them over the edge. He made a vertical climb until he was above the adjacent structures, then briefly ignited his thrusters to push toward the playground. Particle bolts streamed below him between the schoolhouse and the yard. Nath maneuvered into the center of the playground, pointed his nose toward the enemy position, and descended rapidly, squeezing his trigger as he went. Stone architecture exploded as high-energy cannon bolts ripped through the walls. The Y-Wing's weapons were designed to puncture battlecruiser hulls. Anything less sturdy than a cliff wasn't likely to hold up. The third story of the building, where Nath aimed first, became a compressed layer of flames. Then the fourth and fifth levels collapsed, and the entire facade poured like an avalanche onto the yard. The particle bolt volleys ceased. Nath smelled dust in his lungs and nostrils, even knowing it was impossible for the granules to enter the airtight Y-wing. No aerial threat appeared on his scanner. He checked the comm channels and heard troops reporting casualties and scouting the area around the yard. No one called in additional shots. It seemed likely the attackers had been a guerrilla team of Imperial loyalists, not part of any larger or better coordinated unit. Nath peered out his canopy and spotted corpses half buried in the rubble. Like the man Nath had seen in the alley, they appeared to be civilians. He pursed his lips and loosed a long sigh. The casualties might have been avoidable. He wasn't sure how much of the fault was on him, but he imagined the answer was at least a little. Still, he'd had to act fast. Nath adjusted the comm and said,
T5, you and the kid in one piece?
The droid replied with an affirmative ping.
How about our fresh pilots?
This time, the response was a concerned warble. They'd lost at least one of the candidates. This is why you don't get attached, he thought.
All right, see you down there.
He put the casualties out of his mind. His priority was survival, his and Will's, and he'd done exactly what he needed to do. Everyone else on Troyth, his new squadron included, came a distant second. Four. Colonel Soren Keyes had developed a routine. The thought offended him. When suffering was abundant and obliteration was one poor choice away, the complacency of a schedule seemed presumptuous. Yet it allowed him to support the 204th. He could serve his people best as a dependable cog in the machinery of war. For these reasons, he tried to project confidence as he moved about the Radakia Plaza Communications Center and reviewed reports from the 204th and Imperial Loyalists across the planet. He smiled at Governor Yadiz when he crossed her path and tried to communicate his respect for her unkempt, under-equipped guerrilla forces. He acknowledged, through a calm tone and non-confrontational posture more than through words, that his own people had barely slept since arriving, had remained upright and dutiful and attentive without complaint. Neither the squadron commanders nor individual pilots openly blamed him for what had transpired. Part of him wished they would. It troubled Soren to see his people act as if being trapped on Troyth was only incrementally worse than what they'd been through already. As if their colonel's choice to lead them into catastrophe was exactly what they had expected. It wasn't loyalty or faith that kept them dutiful. Rather, it was incomprehension of the alternatives. What did Grandmother do to you? He wondered. What did I do when I left you behind? What have you seen since the Empire died? He was midway through his first four-hour shift as he completed his study of the updated tactical maps with Farah Yadiz. The young woman, for all her dignity and obvious pride in her planet, was more than willing to defer to Soren's expertise in war. Soren hadn't known her much more than 2 days, but already he was coming to relax in her presence. She drank from a thermos containing a stimulant so acrid it made Soren's nose itch. She'd offered him some during their first meeting, and he'd accepted in the spirit of goodwill. Until she'd begun laughing uproariously, he'd sincerely believed that he'd been poisoned. She hunched her head and shoulders over the hollow table far enough that images splashed against her chin like an evening tide. Things will get worse in the Nine Boats District, she said, wrinkling her nose. Do you object? Worse in what way? The hollow image showed a riot, or the aftermath of a riot. Civilians armed with bottles and burning rags stampeded away from a checkpoint established by Yadiz's loyalists. The Imperial forces fired indiscriminately into the crowd. One stormtrooper, who wore no helmet, walked among the injured, executing crawling rioters who'd been left behind by their peers. The troops there suffered... Yadiz hesitated, straightening behind the table.
May I speak freely, Colonel?
You may. She sighed and spoke in a tone of confession.
When word came that the New Republic had arrived in the Cerberon system, Nine Boats was one of the first districts to spiral into chaos. Rebel sympathizers struck before the enemy's ships landed, shutting down tram stations. Local stormtrooper units responded with what I'm told were standard crowd dispersal techniques, but gas and stunners weren't sufficient against the sheer number of rioters. Our troops were overwhelmed and, well, many were beaten to death. Others were shot with their own rifles. Rebels obtained helmet cam footage and broadcast it to the comm networks. Distaste flickered across her face. The survivors, our survivors, have been operating without support over the past 2 months. They've seen awful things. Their leaders are dead, yet the rebels call them monsters. They want vengeance, and I can't stop them.
They won't follow your orders? Sorin asked. There was no condemnation in his voice.
If I were on the ground directing them, of course they would. But if I sit 500 kilometers away, sending encrypted signals they may not have codes to decipher?
Yadiz shrugged.
My grandfather told stories of the Clone Wars, of planets driven to atrocities by starvation and fury.
She trailed off and looked back to the hologram.
I'm not here to pass judgment on your troops or their discipline. In times like these,
Sorin hesitated. May I speak freely, Governor? He wanted to say back to her.
In times like these, none of us are fit to judge the ethics of our peers. All we can do is act as we believe is right and honorable.
And what do you believe, Colonel?
Yadiz asked.
What pole star brings you to Troyth?
Sorin forced a humorless smile. Yadiz was far younger than he, but he recognized the skill of a woman from the political classes. She might have been asking, who gave you the order to come here? What is your mission? Or her inquiry might have been as genuinely personal as it sounded.
I serve my people, he said, as I suspect you do yours.
Governor Farah Yadiz watched the horrors etched in the Hollow's blue light and nodded.
She's intelligent, determined, ignorant of military matters, but I'd expect as much given her background.
Sorin turned over a bruised piece of fruit as he sat in the private meeting room they'd created from the comm center's kitchenette. Bruce and Dorita were with him, the former positioned near the door and the latter perched on the countertop. Both wore flight suits, despite having returned to base over an hour earlier.
You sound taken with her, Bruce said.
Does she know we're planning to dump her the second we get off-world?
Dorita asked.
She hasn't brought it up. I wouldn't be surprised if she suspects. She understands that Troyth is only a small part of the war.
He looked to the closed door, as if he could see through to the world outside.
Still, keep an eye on your pilot. We won't want to get too close to these people.
Captain Dorita laughed low and rubbed her face with gloved hands.
We just got back from carrying messages to the Western Shield Command Base, little fort in the middle of nowhere that never got overrun. They wanted to give us medals just for showing up.
Our experience was similar, Bruce said. No one's spending time fraternizing, but it's easy to forget that we're not here to retake the planet. After the last few months, it's gratifying to be treated like champions coming to the rescue.
Sorin mentally thumbed through a pilot roster, trying to assess his people's likely reactions to being embedded with the forces of Troyth. For those who'd been desperate for purpose, men like Candende, who'd become obsessed with the Emperor's messenger droid, or like Lost Cedia, so hungry for an outlet for her own aggressions and misgivings, it could serve as a source of direction. Others would recall adopting the local forces at Pandem Nye and recruiting the Edict's cadets, and wonder if the same could be done here. If select Troth soldiers could be brought into the 204th. He wondered how Lieutenant Quell would react, wondered whether everything occurring would play to her deep-seated dream of becoming a hero, before recalling that she was long gone. It was tempting to accept the gift of the locals' gratitude and expose all his soldiers, as if it were a disease that would harden their immune systems, not destroy them. I recommend we keep our pilots focused on their duty, he said. There's more than enough to go around. If anyone brings up our objectives, remind them that we succeeded in eliminating the Lodestar. I'd like confirmation of General Syndulla's death, but until we have it, emphasize what we know we accomplished. Bruce and Arita both seemed to accept the answer, and the three of them proceeded to discuss the ground crew's triage efforts, and whether they'd be able to repair the worst damaged ties. They were just wrapping up when one of the governor's aides announced that the new Republic forces had been located. They were in High Garden for a full day, Yadiz said, spinning the holographic globe until a blinking dot appeared in one of the decaying sections of the eastern city. One of the largest groups of New Republic infantry we've seen active, along with limited air support. Somehow they acquired transportation after an ambush last night, and they're now on the move. We don't yet know where. How did you acquire this information? Sorin asked. Multiple local sightings, compiled by an operative from the old governor's, Special Intelligence Unit. We were lucky he happened to be in the area. There was no tinge of doubt in her voice. Sorin nodded. Go on. Based on that information, plus unconfirmed sightings here and here, she jabbed at two points, creating a line leading away from Highgarden. We've begun compiling a list of possible targets, strategic outposts they might be moving to attack or occupy. Yadiz tapped a button and 20 new dots flashed into existence, each labeled with a name and a set of coordinates. Sorin wished he possessed the expertise to make immediate sense of it all. If Syndulla was still alive, he thought, she surely knew exactly what she was doing. And while he believed he was the superior pilot, he had no doubt she was the superior general. Add to that her familiarity with the terrain, and he would consider himself lucky if she'd died with the Lodestar. Tell me about them, he said. All of them. Yadiz did. For 30 minutes, Sorin listened intently. He was broadly familiar with many of the targets from his earlier studies of the planet, but Yadiz's insights were useful, and he needed time to process what he was seeing. As she described the significance of the Hurn Skyway, however, and the possibility that the New Republic hoped to seize control of transportation infrastructure, his eyes roamed to a distant light on the map. He kept half his attention on Yadiz as he pulled up files, finally seeing fit to interrupt her with, "What about the mining facility?" "Cornine?" Yadiz paused and did not adjust the map. It's the least likely of the targets, but it is potentially accessible to the enemy. There's not much they could do there, though. But it's functional? Sorin asked. He tapped the screen he'd been eyeing a moment before. The New Republic could be after the equipment there, believing it's unguarded. It was never decommissioned. I don't know how much is online. Sorin nodded. Yadiz was watching him, openly curious. He wondered what she thought he was thinking. We can return to it later, Sorin said. Apologies. Continue with the Skyway. Yadiz did. Soren gave her his attention again, but in the back of his mind, he explored possibilities. Whatever the New Republic intended, whether they were after the Core 9 mega facility or another target, the mine was a solution to all of his problems. It had everything the 204th required. He would reprioritize accordingly. It was unfortunate that he would need to betray the governor, but Colonel Soren Keyes had pledged to serve his people first. Chapter 16. Deep Beyond Day. 1. Time was oblique to them. The droid's internal chronometer was unreliable due to damage. Erica Quell had carried an emergency timepiece, but it had shattered in the crash, and she'd abandoned it in the freighter. The rising and setting of the Cerberon black hole over the planetoid's horizon made a mockery of night and day. The light of the burning iris was bright enough to make travel easier, yet without knowing the planetoid's rotation period, it told them nothing about how long they'd been stranded. Even the rhythms of their bodies were deceptive. Quell and Aiden's injuries forced them to rest often and denied them deep sleep. They made camp when they felt unable to go farther and resumed their journey when frustration and anxiety drove them onward. ITO had said that it had spotted something, a shadow, perhaps only a mountain or a chasm, or perhaps a structure, during its fall. The direction correlated with what Quell and the droid could remember of the energy reading's location. So they tracked east, hoping to come upon something that would save them before the planetoid was torn apart by the black hole.
If it's true that my captors were here, Aiden said, it doesn't seem likely we'll find anything worthwhile.
They slogged through a wide valley, ridges towering over them. The sand was looser and offered less traction than before their descent. The gravel had disintegrated and only dust was left.
If there was a base or a communications outpost, they would have stripped it bare. We don't know that, Quell replied. We don't know there's anything here at all. But why else would they have come in the middle of a war?
It was a reasonable question, yet it made Quell want to shove Aiden's face into the sand until he choked.
What if it was the Empire that knocked the planetoid out of orbit? She asked. What if they wanted to destroy what was here and make sure no one could recover it?
Aiden twisted his neck, staring at her a moment before looking back to the sand. They trudged forward, and when Quell began to believe the conversation was over, Aiden said,
There were reports of secret vaults and laboratories targeted for destruction after Endor, supposedly on the orders of the Emperor himself. That was the less glamorous part of Operation Cinder, but it was still a part.
The wind rose. Quell felt cold. Aiden was mocking her, she thought. Maybe she deserved it.
If she's a spy, she's not an especially good one,
the interrogation droid said. The unit floated a short distance behind them. Both Quell and Aiden turned. Its primary manipulator arm twitched, and its photoreceptor was dilated. Then it seemed to steady.
Apologies,
it said.
My memory circuits are faulty. I was momentarily confused. Please continue.
They walked on. They did not return to the topic of what they might find at their destination. They marched between the cliffs, trudging through sand like ashes under a star-bright sky blotted with the flotsam of the debris field. Cerberon, forever ravenous, rose overhead, and the wind howled and dust danced. They didn't speak again of Operation Cinder, yet they broke their collective silence more often. Aiden asked what had happened during Shadow Wing's attack, and Quell explained all she knew in a monotone. From the arrival of the Star Destroyer and the cruise carrier, to the deployment of New Republic ships to Katadra and the interception over Troyth. When Aiden asked why she hadn't led Alphabet herself,
She told him,
"Because they got your message."
He didn't reply to that. Later, when he asked how she knew it was Shadowwing, she told him about Nath Tenzin's signal.
"It's possible,"
he said when she was finished, "that it never was Shadowwing. Tenzin could have gotten it wrong."
"He wasn't wrong,"
she said.
"I saw them. Obsession might have colored your opinion."
"I saw Major Keyes," she thought. "My mentor shot us down. There's no one else it could have been." But she didn't say it. She had told Aiden that Keyes died on Necronus, and telling the truth now would raise subjects she had no desire to address. Instead, she shrugged away his doubt and took the offensive.
"If you'd done your part," she said, her voice low and steady, "they would have taken the bait. They'd be on the asteroid right now, waiting to be ambushed by the 61st.
Aiden swore softly and said something Quell couldn't hear. She knew what he meant all the same. The interrogation droid said nothing. Quell had always thought of ITO as a peacemaker, but Aiden was its master, and maybe she should have been grateful it wasn't taking sides. The valley twisted so often that, after the black hole fell below the ridgeline, Quell no longer knew in what direction they traveled. The cliffs had become increasingly steep over the course of the day, or eternal night, or whatever it was, and climbing, injured as they were, was out of the question.
"There's no point going back. We'll keep moving until we find a way out of the valley," Quell said,
and Aiden did not argue. They didn't find a way out. The wind changed with the disappearance of the black hole, lashing them in cutting ribbons edged with particles of sand. They strayed to the cliff wall for shelter, but it wasn't enough. When a whip snapped across Quell's legs and dropped her to the ground, she loosed a frustrated howl and called for a halt. Aiden voiced agreement, and she noticed for the first time how his face glistened with sweat. Forcing down her resentment, she offered him the day's accumulation of water from the evaporator. He drank most of it and handed back the canteen without thanks. They found a hollow in the cliff where they made camp. It extended no more than 5 meters past the broad, jagged cave mouth, but it was oppressively dark, and Quell wished for a glow rod or anything brighter than the droid's indicators. ITO reported that it found nothing concerning during its full spectrum scans, and they settled into rest.
"At least we're out of the wind,"
Quell thought, before falling into a sore and troubled sleep. It was black as ever when she woke. She didn't know if she'd rested for 1 hour or 8, though she felt not at all refreshed, and her head throbbed from dehydration. The sound of the gusts outside was faint, but the cave echoed with a lower keening. Quell worried it was the droid's repulsors malfunctioning, but she didn't see the unit's lights. As her eyes adjusted, she saw Aiden standing above her an arm's length away, staring at the cave wall and moaning. His antenna stalks were half raised, though one was still unnaturally bent from his captivity. The moaning stopped as Quell shuffled to a squatting position.
"I need a drink,"
Aiden said.
"I'll check the evaporator," Quell said. "I need a drink,"
Aiden repeated, and twisted to look at her with a fury that burned hot enough to show